Now, our topic today is cost-effective approaches in juvenile and adult corrections, what works, what doesn't. You may be asking yourself, why is corrections the topic of our 25th seminar? This topic was selected by our Family Impact Seminar, Legislator, and Gubernatorial Advisory Committee. So we interviewed all 11 members of this committee in July, and corrections was at the top of the list for Democrats and Republicans alike. Legislators told us they want to keep the public safe, but they recognize that corrections is taking a bigger and bigger bite out of the state budget. In the decade between 1996 and 2006, costs have increased from $368 million to $956 million just last year. And during the same 10-year time span, incarceration rates have increased 65%. And as you'll hear from Steve Oss today, studies show that when incarceration rates go up by 10%, crime rates go down by about 3%. Yet incarceration is costly. So legislators tell us they're interested in ways to spend less on prison, to save taxpayer dollars, and still curb crime. So why are the Family Impact Seminars interested in this issue? The strongest predictor of juvenile crime is ineffective parenting, particularly during the preschool years. And you'll hear from Steve Oss that the programs that yield the greatest return on investment are those targeted at juveniles, often using family approaches. And what many of these programs do is try to recreate the powerful socialization forces of functional family life. And you'll hear from Larry Steinberg that parents are one important factor in helping even serious juvenile offenders turn their lives around. So today's format, each speaker is going to have 30 minutes. I'll take questions after each speaker, and we'll still have time for questions at the end. Let me proceed to our first speaker, Dr. Lawrence Steinberg. Larry is a distinguished university professor, and he holds an endowed chair at Temple University in Philadelphia. He's also director of the MacArthur Foundation Research Network on Adolescent Development and Juvenile Justice. He's written over 250 scholarly articles, 8 books on growth and development during the teenage years. Since 1976, he's had 60 grants to support his work. He's given over 260 presentations, including briefings for Congress, testifying at state legislatures, and speaking to organizations including the American Bar Association, the National Conference of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, the National Conference of State Legislatures, the National Institute of Justice, and the United States Department of Justice. He's received many awards, including an award for lifetime contributions to the study of adolescence from the Society for Research on Adolescence, and an award for lifetime contributions to developmental psychology from the American Psychological Association. So in academic circles, Larry Steinberg is a household name. I've heard him give many talks, and I especially appreciate his great sense of humor, particularly about his experiences as a parent. Now, it's been said that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So someone asked his son, Ben, who was about 15 at the time, what it was like to grow up with a world-renowned adolescent psychologist as a father. Without missing a beat, Ben said, "I wouldn't know." Isn't that just like a kid? He's not famous. He's my dad. So let's give a warm Wisconsin welcome to Dr. Larry Steinberg.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. And Karen, thank you for inviting me here. You know, in going over my bio, Karen neglected one of the most important aspects of it, which is that I taught at UW-Madison for 5 years in the mid and late 1980s, and that ungrateful child she referred to was born here at Madison General Hospital. I want to talk about the current policy context of juvenile justice, in which you all are now debating possible changes in your juvenile justice system, set the stage for some work that we've done in our MacArthur network on adolescent development and juvenile justice, and tell you what we're learning about important changes in individuals' capacities and potential during the adolescent years. So let's talk about the current policy context first. There's been a big change in the last couple of decades in the United States away from traditional models of juvenile justice in which adolescents were treated quite differently than adults, and in which juvenile delinquency was viewed very different from adult crime, toward what some of us think of as the criminalization of delinquency. So we see more and more transfer of kids to from juvenile to criminal court, harsher punishments of adolescents who are adjudicated or tried in juvenile court, and less individualization of sentences or what are called dispositions in the juvenile court. And lots of people say that if you look at what goes on in most juvenile courts around the country, this is not only Wisconsin, this is all over the United States, they look more and more like adult courts. It's really harder and harder to tell the difference between the two institutions. But in recent years, in the last maybe 3 or 4 years, it looks like the pendulum is swinging back in the other direction, toward more differences between juvenile and adult procedures and outcomes, and a more traditional juvenile court model. What evidence do we have of this? Well, the juvenile death penalty was abolished by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2005. A number of states, including you here in Wisconsin, are talking about changing the age of criminal court jurisdiction. Most states set that at 18. Wisconsin has it at 17. A couple of states have it at 16. A number of states that have it at lower than 18 are talking about raising it to 18. There's an increasing awareness of the intersection of mental health problems and juvenile crime and juvenile justice, with new and better research indicating that a very, very high proportion of kids in the juvenile justice system have serious mental health problems, and that without addressing those mental health problems, we have to live with a lot of juvenile crime, which may be the result of some of those mental health problems. And I think there's a growing awareness of the fact that kids are just different from adults, and that we ought to be thinking about those differences as we construct rational juvenile justice policy. So for the last 10 years, I directed a national initiative for the MacArthur Foundation, which was attempting to bring a developmental perspective to questions of law and public policy. And we ask, how are kids different from adults in ways that should inform policy and practice? And our work is focused on three main questions. Do adolescents have the abilities necessary to participate as competent trial defendants? Do they have the capacities necessary to be held fully responsible for their conduct? And what is known about altering the developmental course of offending during adolescence and early adulthood?
Is everyone hearing Larry okay?
Good. And I want to talk about some studies that we've done that address each of these questions. The first was the MacArthur Competence Study, which was a national study of individuals' competence to stand trial, or at least the study of their abilities relevant to their competence to stand trial. This was done in 4 different data collection sites across the country. We recruited our sample from detention centers and jails, but also from communities and targeted neighborhoods. So half the sample had justice system involvement, whether they were adults or kids, and half the sample did not. It was an ethnically and economically diverse sample of 1,400 people between the ages of 11 and 24. We took a standard competence assessment instrument, the kind that's used all over the country, and we performed a competence assessment on all these people. And we were especially interested in looking at the responses of individuals in comparison to the responses of people that had been found not competent to stand trial. And so in this next slide, what I'm going to show you are the percentages of people at different ages who were as impaired as individuals who had been found not competent to stand trial using this exact same measure. What do we do when we assess competence? Competence to stand trial involves a number of things that are specified in the U.S. Constitution. You need to understand court procedures. You need to be able to reason with facts. You need to be able to make decisions when you're being interrogated by the police or consulting with your attorney, or when you've been offered a plea agreement and have to decide whether to accept it or reject it. So we use a standard structured interview, and there's a manual for how you code people's responses to this, and you get scores depending upon your answers to these different questions. And so we can compare the scores of people of different ages and ask, well, are 15-year-olds as competent as 24-year-olds? And so this slide shows the percentage of people at different ages with seriously impaired understanding or reasoning. Now, it looks like the bottom part of the slide is cut off there on the projection. So let me just say that the four columns going left to right are 11 to 13-year-olds, 14 to 15-year-olds, 16 to 17-year-olds, and then the adults, the 18 to 24-year-olds. So what you see here is that the percentage of kids who are between 11 and 13 who are not competent at a level that's equivalent to impaired adults who were found not competent to stand trial is about a third or so. And about a fifth of the 14 and 15-year-olds are as impaired as mentally ill adults who were found not competent to stand trial. Now, this is important because those kids are normal. We didn't have mentally ill kids in the sample. When you get to the 16 and 17-year-olds, there's no differences between their level of competence and the adults. But this suggests that there are some developmental changes that take place during the adolescent years that affect individuals' capacity to function as competent defendants in a case, and that needs to be thought about and taken into account when we construct our age boundaries between adolescence and adulthood. We also asked kids a series of questions, and I normally talk about this one study for an hour, so I'm giving you a very abbreviated look at this. We also asked kids questions about what they would do in certain situations. These data that I'm about to show you come from kids' responses to questions about what they would do if they were being interrogated by the police for a crime that they had committed. Okay? And we gave them three choices. Would you talk to the police and admit that you had done it? Would you talk to the police and lie and deny that you had done it? Or would you remain silent? And so this is the percentage of people who say that they would talk to the police and admit that they had done it. And you see that it just goes down in a linear fashion as people get older. I don't want to insult any prosecutors who might be in the audience, but any defense attorney would tell you that the right thing to do if you've been arrested for a crime that you've committed is to remain silent until your lawyer can get there and help you. It's not good to talk and to admit a crime to the police. I know we don't maybe teach our kids to behave that way at home, but the way they behave at home is not the way that they should behave when they're potentially facing very, very serious trouble. What you see here is that at no age do people think it's good to lie to the police. And so the big change really is in the percentage of people at different ages who say that the right thing to do is to remain silent. Now, this is important because it's clear that little kids, 11 to 13-year-olds and 14 to 15-year-olds, really don't know what to do when they're being interrogated by the police, which means we need special protections for them in that context. So a significant proportion of normal people, 15 and younger, may lack the abilities necessary to be a competent defendant. We also found, I didn't show you a slide on this, that these deficiencies are especially apparent among younger and lower IQ individuals. We don't see any differences from age 16 on, and these deficiencies extend beyond just competence to stand trial as it's conventionally defined, but also impair kids' judgment when they're being interrogated, when they're consulting with their attorneys, when they're making decisions about plea agreements and so forth. And I'm happy to take questions about any of these studies afterwards. I know that I'm going pretty quickly here. The second study I want to talk to you a little bit about is the culpability study. New research on brain maturation shows continued maturation into the mid-20s. This is a finding that has emerged in the last decade or so. People previously thought that most brain maturation was over by the time people were 13 or 14. That's clearly not the case. And the maturation that we see in adolescent brain development is especially important for things like executive functions, which are things like planning and thinking ahead, anticipating the future consequences of your actions. It's also very important for things like the coordination of emotion and thinking, which affects impulse control, resistance to peer pressure, and other situations in which your feelings and your reasoning may have to be reconciled with each other. And one question that our group asked is, should these developmental changes affect the way that we treat adolescents under the law? Because many of the things that develop during this time period are relevant to our judgments of how blameworthy people are. So the question really that we were asking is whether immaturity makes adolescents inherently less responsible than adults for their conduct. So let me just sort of step back from the slide for a second and say that everybody that I've ever spoken to agrees that there is some age below which we shouldn't hold people fully responsible for what they do. You might think it's 5 years old. You might think it's 10 years old. You might think it's 16 years old. But everybody agrees that there's some age. That if you had a case in which a 3-year-old picked up a gun and shot somebody, you would not view that the same way you would if a 23-year-old did the same thing. Right? So what we're studying here is not whether there should be some age boundary, but what that age boundary ought to be and how we define it. And the reason that these capacities are important is that some deficiencies that you have might mitigate your criminal responsibility. We know that adolescents are still learning to modulate their impulses and regulate their emotions. We also know that under the law, when you commit a crime that's emotional, that's impulsive, you're punished less severely than if you commit the same crime and it's premeditated. And so if adolescents can't control their impulses, then they're less likely to be able to engage in premeditated crime, and they shouldn't be held as blameworthy as adults. Now, we're not saying they should be excused. It's just a question of whether we should punish them at the same level as somebody who is more mature. Similarly, they're still learning to foresee and take into account the long-term consequences of their actions and to delay short-term gratification. They're more susceptible to peer influence and more dependent on peer approval than adults. And these impairments are not really in traditional conceptualizations of cognitive ability, but in but with respect to immaturity in their psychological and emotional functioning. This is a hard thing for people to understand, because when I get asked by legislators or journalists about questions like this, and the typical question is, well, don't they know the difference between right and wrong? And the answer is that, of course they do. I mean, even my dogs know the difference between right and wrong. That's a very low bar. The question really is whether they can comport themselves in ways that are consistent with what they know. So we studied 935 individuals between 10 and 30, 5 different locales across the country. We gave them different measures of planning, preference for immediate gratification, impulsivity, risk perception, sensation seeking, susceptibility to peer pressure. We also gave them measures of basic intellectual ability, and we asked, really, at what age do individuals demonstrate adult levels of maturity, and does this age differ across different aspects of development? Let me just walk you through this slide. It's a little hard to process just at first. What we did was we took the average score of the 26 to 30-year-olds in our sample, and we said, what percentage of people at different ages scores at the average for the adults in our sample? And what's important here to see, in these two lines, one shows intellectual ability, and one shows the psychosocial maturity, things like resisting peer pressure, controlling impulses, and so forth. And what you see here is that by age 16 or 17, kids are just as smart as adults. I know that's very depressing to realize that you're not going to get any smarter than you were when you were 16. But that's the truth in that kind of smartness. But if you look at things like impulse control, thinking ahead, resisting peer pressure, it takes much, much longer to reach adult levels of maturity. In fact, people aren't reaching adult levels of maturity, guess what, until they're adults. And so when we ask this question, well, when should we draw the boundary between kids and adults? When are kids as mature as adults? The answer really depends on what do you mean by maturity. And to the extent that the law says we ought to take into account things like thinking ahead, resisting peer pressure, controlling your impulses, then kids clearly are not as mature as adults until their 20s. So what do we learn from this study of psychosocial maturity relevant to culpability? Well, the developmental course of intellectual and psychosocial maturity follow very different patterns. Intellectual abilities increase in early adolescence, but they plateau around age 16. Psychosocial, emotional maturity, if you will, is fairly stable from 10 to 14, but then steadily increases between 14 into the late 20s, with gains in impulse control, delay of gratification, planning, future orientation, resistance to peer influence, risk perception, and risk aversion. That's why our kids can be so smart and do such stupid things. All right, I'll tell you a little story about Ben. When Ben was about 14 or so, he was sleeping over at the house of a couple of his friends, and they decided to sneak out at 2 o'clock in the morning and go out to another house in the neighborhood where there was a girl whom one of the boys was interested in. They get to the girl's house, and they take some pebbles and they throw them at her window, you know, sort of Romeo and Juliet style. The pebbles, see, this didn't happen to Romeo. The pebbles set off the burglar alarm. So this loud siren goes off. And what the boys didn't know was that it also sent a silent alarm to the local police precinct station. And what did our smart, educated, middle-class children do? They just ran. And they ran down the street. And they ran right into the patrol car that was coming up the street. So now they have a decision to make. What do these smart kids do? They run in different directions. And the police end up chasing one of the kids, and they catch him, and they bring him home, and they talk to his parents, and they tell him that he shouldn't be out at 2 o'clock in the morning, and so on. And I found out about this the next day when our phone rang at 7 o'clock in the morning. And it was the mother of the girl whose house they had thrown the pebbles at. And she said to me, "Do you know where Ben was last night?" And I said, "Yes, he was sleeping over at Brad's house." And she said, "Well, not exactly." And this was especially embarrassing because not only was she the mother of another child at my son's school, but she was my wife's gynecologist, which somehow makes it seem more embarrassing. And I then, you know, hung the phone up, called Ben on his cell phone, woke him up, you know, Sunday morning at 7:15, and said, "If you have children, you know that's not a time when kids are usually awake." I said, "Get your things together, meet me in front of Brad's house, I'm coming right there." So he groggily, so then I drive over there, he comes out, he gets in the car, I read him the Riot Act. I said, "Do you realize how stupid it is to run from armed police in the dark who think that they're interrupting a burglary? What were you thinking?" And he said, "That's the problem, Dad. I wasn't." And this is how I've come to understand why kids can be as smart as us, school smart-wise, and still do such stupid things, because many of the developments that are stopping them from doing those stupid things are still developing. The hard part from a policy point of view is that there isn't an inflection point in this curve of social-emotional maturity where we can look at it and say, yeah, it's right there. It's at 17 years and 3 months when people become adults, because development is very, very gradual in this respect. Okay, third and last study. A study called Research on Pathways to Desistance. This is a study that is asking really what works for kids that have gotten into serious trouble with the law. We know what gets kids involved in crime. Ms. Karen mentioned the family is critically important. Good family relationships is one of the most important protective factors against involvement in crime. And there's, you know, 60 years of good research telling us what gets kids involved in crime. But we don't know, surprisingly enough, what gets kids to stop committing crimes after they've become involved in criminal behavior. We do know that most adolescents who've been delinquent desist from criminal activity during adolescence. A small proportion continue into early adulthood, but almost none of them become chronic offenders. These facts are very, very well established. Crime peaks at around 17 or 18, and then it just declines dramatically and rapidly, and by the time you get into the mid-20s, there are very few people that are committing crimes. So if we can figure out what leads to desistance from crime, we can design better interventions, we can make better predictions about which kids are risks to public safety, we can allocate resources more wisely, and of course, the bottom line, we can save a lot of money. It costs a lot to lock people up, and Steve Oss is going to be talking about that. It doesn't cost anywhere near as much to treat them in the community. So if we could figure out which people we should lock up, because there are some that we should lock up, and which people we shouldn't, we could save an awful lot of money. Maybe $40,000 per person for each of those decisions where we say this person can be managed in the community, doesn't need to be put into a correctional facility. So we've been doing this study in Philadelphia and in Phoenix. We've been following about 1,350 kids who were committed felonies. They were all convicted of felonies. So these are serious crimes. Armed robbery, aggravated assault, rape. They all committed the crime that got them into our study when they were between 14 and 17. We will follow them for 8 years. We see them every 6 months at the beginning of the study, then annually after that. We also interview them anytime they've been released from an institutional placement. This is kind of a little wobbly up there, but this shows the developmental trajectories of offending behavior over time. And in this study, we identify five distinct groups of kids. Group number one are kids who, even though they got into the study by committing a serious crime, they didn't have a lot of priors, and they didn't really keep committing crimes over the course of the study. That's that lowest line with the square markers on it. And group number two is very, very similar. They're a little bit more involved in delinquency behavior at the beginning of the study, but they also don't commit a lot of crimes over the course of the study. Now, these two groups add up to 58% of the sample, right? So this is a lot of people. Remember, these are serious offenders, but 58% of the sample are not committing crimes. We have a group of moderate offenders who are committing a fair number of crimes at the beginning of the study and stay at that level over the course of the study. And then we have these two groups, groups four and group five. They start out as very, very involved in crime. I won't go into what that score means, but that is a lot of crime if they're up there on that scale that high. But look, one of them stays really high over time, and one of them desists. Those are the kids we're interested in because we want to know what happened that made those kids stop offending. Because they started at a really high level. Some of the other kids at that high level kept offending over time at pretty much the same rate. So our study aims at asking, what is it about these kids that's leading them to desist from crime? And what is it about the chronic offenders who stay chronic? Here's what we're finding so far. The majority of juvenile offenders, even across the whole sample, are arrested at least once within 2 years. Recidivism is a terrible, terrible problem in the juvenile justice system, and we have to just face that. I mean, every study has found that there's a high rate of repeat offending. But the good news is that group of high chronic offenders is small. It's less than 10%, and this is an estimate that many, many studies have reached. Right, 10% of the juvenile offenders in this country account for the vast bulk of serious crime. The challenge for our system is to identify which kids are in that 10% group. Unfortunately, we don't seem to be able to predict which ones they are. And I'm telling you, if we can't predict it, I don't think anybody can predict it, because we measure everything there is to know about these kids. Our initial interview with these kids is a 4-hour-long assessment. We see them every 6 months for 2 hours. What's interesting about what doesn't predict is that it's not only characteristics of the kids that don't predict, like their family backgrounds or their intelligence or their neighborhoods. It's also characteristics of what happens to them in the system that doesn't predict. Some of these kids got locked up. Some of these kids didn't get locked up. It didn't affect their pattern of crime over time. Kids got different kinds of services. It didn't affect their pattern of crime over time. Now, maybe somebody out there is smarter than we are and can find those factors that are predictive. The one thing that does seem to make a big difference is substance abuse. And it's very clear to us that the most serious kids come into the system with substance abuse problems. And if we could do something about that, we can reduce juvenile crime and reduce reoffending. So what works and what doesn't work based on what we are learning so far? Incarceration has no impact at all on reoffending beyond the immediate effect of incapacitation. So when kids are locked up, whether in an adult facility or a juvenile facility, they're not committing crimes because they're locked up. But as soon as you let them out, they're just as likely to commit crimes as kids that never had been locked up at all. So you get whatever positive benefit you get from locking kids up just by keeping them locked up. But there doesn't seem to be any deterrent effect on those kids once they're let out. We find that the harsher the sanctions are, the more punitive the sanctions are, the more likely kids are to reoffend when they get released. This is particularly bad when kids are in harsh environments and they're grouped with a lot of other antisocial individuals. Right? They learn how to become better criminals from this kind of context. Substance abuse treatment reduces reoffending, short term, but the effect disappears if you stop the treatment. We really need to get people in the field to think of substance abuse as a chronic condition that needs to be managed over time, right? Like diabetes or hypertension. It's not something that can be treated with a one-shot intervention and that's going to go away. Effective parenting has a deterrent impact on reoffending, mainly by diminishing contact with antisocial peers. Supervising kids out in the community intensively seems to increase their participation in school and work, and those are good things as well. So we need active probation supervision of kids after they've been released. It also is the case that kids tell us that the more they think that they're going to get caught for doing something, the less likely they are to do it. And so effective policing and swift response and certain response to kids who commit crime is going to be a deterrent as well. So let me just conclude with some potential implications for policy. But Karen told me, don't tell you what to do policy-wise. Just present the science and you'll figure it out. But I have my own ignorant opinions, and if you want to know what they are, you can ask me during the Q&A. Adolescents mature intellectually before they mature socially and emotionally. When we talk about where we should draw the line between adolescence and adulthood, we need to think about what are we drawing the line for and what capabilities are relevant to that particular question. There's a clear breakpoint between 15 and 16, and we see this in the competence study, but after that, development looks like it's very, very gradual. Only a small minority of serious juvenile offenders become career criminals. If we can identify who those people are, we can save the state an awful lot of money. Some sanctions have unanticipated and harmful effects. One of those sanctions is transferring kids to the adult system. And I'll take questions on this later, but there are now a half a dozen studies that all reach the same conclusion, which is that when kids are tried and punished as adults and they come out of the system, they're more likely to offend and more likely to offend faster, sooner, than kids who went in for similar crimes but were treated as juveniles. So it's costly to sanction kids as adults. Family-based interventions, and I know that Steve is going to talk about this, so I'll just say this one bullet point here. Family-based interventions in the community hold a tremendous amount of promise. Doing things to increase parental effectiveness is going to help prevent a lot of juvenile crime, and it's going to help prevent a lot of juvenile offending. One of the things that surprised us, and I think surprises most people, is that parents continue to make a difference, even when kids are in middle and late adolescence. And even the parents of kids that we think all have bad parents, which is not true, even parenting in that population seems to make a difference and seems to help kids desist from crime. So I'm going to stop there, and then I'm happy to revisit any of these points during the question and answer period.
Okay, we're going to take some questions, and the purpose of our questions here is to give state legislators and state agency administrators a chance to ask questions of our speakers. And I see a state legislator right here who has a question. And Representative Sherman, we're going to ask you to speak into the mic. Heidi's okay. Got a mic.
Is that one activated? Hello? Yeah, it works.
Yeah. Matt, does either mic work? Okay.
I have actually two questions. The first is you mentioned your lack of ability to predict.
Right.
That, as I understood it, previous studies showed that that lack of ability to predict was more on the false positive side. In fact, I've heard 2-to-1 false positives, meaning you thought more kids were going to reoffend than actually would.
Yes.
Your studies show about the same thing?
I think it's probably a little bit bigger than, you know, bigger than 2-to-1, but I'd say that's probably around there. Yeah. That you would probably identify maybe 30% of the kids as likely to be chronic reoffenders, and only 10% of them are.
Okay, thanks. My other question is completely different.
Yeah.
As I understand what a drug court program is, that it's a long-term intervention, at least 2 years.
Yes.
And it seems to meet most of the standards that you put up at the end of your presentation. Does your study deal at all with the success of drug court programs? We've heard in previous presentations that they're very successful.
Yes.
Models.
Yes, I've heard that too. No, in the particular jurisdictions in which we're working, drug courts have not yet caught on. I mean, we're in just two cities, Philadelphia and Phoenix, and they're not widely used. But I go to a lot of conferences where this is discussed, and I think the evidence is pretty good in favor of drug courts. Is Steve going to talk about that?
Yeah, he is.
Okay, so he knows more about that than I do.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, Representative Grigsby.
Thank you. Is this on? Is it on? Okay. Thank you for your presentation. We've been working very hard here to try to raise the age of adult jurisdiction, as you know. And I thought was another problem that we have here is that we have the highest rate of disparity when it comes to incarcerating youth of color. And what I thought was interesting about your story is that you told us about the young guys that set off the burglar alarm is that they had the opportunity to go back home, whereas in some localities, certainly in Milwaukee, they probably wouldn't have went back home. They would have now been processed in a system and had a record that would have followed them for the rest of, you know, their lives, certainly if they were 17 years old. So I think it's important to understand that the fact that we have this 17-year-old age of adult jurisdiction has a profound impact on who ends up in the system and who doesn't. So I just wanted to add that to your story. But I guess what I would ask you is you've seen what other states have done. And one of the things that we're really challenged with is that we know it costs a lot more to treat a young person in a juvenile facility than it does just to lock them up in an adult facility. And do you have any ideas or any strategies that other states have used to help with that funding problem? Because that's the reality, that it does cost a lot more to actually provide the treatment services that they need. And then also, how do we move from the punishment paradigm to actually helping people to understand? I mean, I'm so glad that a lot of my colleagues are here, because I think it's important that we understand that throwing people away in jail is not having any impact on recidivism rates. So how do we move from the punishment paradigm to the treatment paradigm as well?
Okay. Let me address all three of your points, if I may. I didn't talk about it today, but we are doing a lot of work on disproportionate minority contact. It occurs at all points, not just at the policing point. It occurs at the point of making decisions about diversion versus detention. It occurs at dispositional decision making, where kids of color get harsher sentences for the same offenses as white kids do. And we are doing some work in four states now trying to understand the processes through which this takes place. You know, I think that there isn't just one solution to it, because it's caused by a lot of different kinds of disparities that all come together and add up to a big discrepancy. I guess I would challenge the idea that it's cheaper to incarcerate a kid in adult prison than in a juvenile facility. It's cheaper today. It's not cheaper over the long run. It's not cheaper if kids are committing more crimes when they come out of the adult facility, because now you've got, two crimes to deal with instead of one. It's not cheaper if treating kids as adults increases their mental health problems, which it does, because now we've got to provide mental health services for those individuals once they leave the adult system. It's not cheaper if it deflects their educational and work trajectories in ways that make them less able to participate in the labor force, because you've got lost tax revenue there and increased services as well. What we have done in states that we have helped think this through is to encourage them to take a bigger sweep at this financially than just saying, well, you know, it's $50,000 in a juvenile facility and $40,000 in an adult facility, therefore it's cheaper. When you add it all up and you project it all out, and again, Steve is the expert on this, it is not cheaper at all. As for the punitive versus rehabilitative issue, let me just share two things. The first is that politicians don't really understand public attitudes about this. We've conducted and we've just replicated a study in four different states in which we determined how much in additional tax dollars individuals would pay for rehabilitative services in contrast to extended incarceration if they were told that they would yield the same benefit. In other words, we presented them with scenarios and said, doing this will reduce crime by 30%. Half the sample got, this is providing more education services, more mental health services, and so on and so forth. Half the other sample got the exact same scenario, except that this was extending the length of lockup for this kid. And then we determined through a widely used methodology called willingness to pay how much in additional taxes people would pay for either of those alternatives. And people are willing to pay more money for rehabilitation than incarceration as long as it yields the same result. What's really important and where I think we are now, where we hadn't been before, is that thanks to work like Steve Ose and his colleagues, we have a much better idea of what works and what doesn't work, and we have a much better idea of the cost effectiveness of different interventions. And so I think the reason that we believe it's a promising time for change is that we are moving from a point where people say nothing works, therefore all we can do is lock these kids up, to understanding that not everything works, but some things work, and that the things that work can be delivered at a much cheaper price than incarceration and punishment. And so it's important to recognize that when politicians think that they're acting on behalf of their constituency, they're often not. The public is in support of rehabilitation as long as they can be shown that the specific programs work.